Thanks very much. It's always good to get the old guy early in the morning. We might still be awake to talk, so that's good. They tricked me a little bit in that they've got me doing an invited talk tomorrow, so all my jokes are going to be tomorrow. You're going to get straight talk today, and that's really kind of sad for you, but you get what you get. So when I started in 1970, we look back, and information assurance really started a long time before that. It was communication security. If you think about it, it dates back at least to the ancient Greeks. The method then was they would take a messenger, shave his head, tattoo a message on top of it, let the hair grow back, and then send him off to deliver the message. This is low bandwidth. New meaning to one-time pad, too, because you really can't reuse that. So things have progressed since then a little bit. Now, when I started in 1970, we were ComSec, Communication Security, and what that really meant was we were trying to protect communications. Over the years, that communication security was joined with CompuSec when computers came around. We got to information security where we were really securing the information. Then we realized that there was no way we could really secure it, and so it became information assurance where we kind of hedged our bets and said, well, you know, it's kind of safe. That's where we are today. It's kind of safe. Now, if you think about when this really became important, it was back in the early wars where communications were used to align troops, tell them when to do things, when not to do things. So even back in the Civil War, if you look in our museum, we have some really nice examples of the communication security that was used back then. Really came to light in World War II, where we had Enigma and Purple. If you're familiar with that, the Germans had a machine called Enigma, and they were communicating over that cipher. It was a rotor machine. They were taking out a lot of planes and a lot of ships, and it was tough. The Germans knew there was a weakness in Enigma. They didn't think that anybody would spend the money to actually exploit it. Well, Poland knew about the weakness, and they told the UK and the US. We actually spent quite a bit of money building special to purpose devices called the bomb to break this. There's an example of the bomb in the museum if you want to see it. It's actually set up to break. At the end of the war, the Russians took the Enigmas and started using them. So the bomb in the museum is set up to break the Russian version of Enigma, not the German version. But it would have worked. It could have been set up to break the German version. The mistake that the Germans made was thinking that no one would spend the money to go after their communications. Because if you think about it, if you're losing ships and planes, it's worth a lot of money to stop losing those ships and planes. And the U.S. spent that money, and that was a turning point in the war. It's huge. So after World War II, we decided, we really don't ever want to be in that position where we think our communications are secure because we don't think people are going to exploit them. Well, National Security Agency was set up, and the emphasis was on security. Security was their middle name, so that was where they were. Very different than today's world. So what did we do back in the 70s when we evaluated things? Well, if you look at something like Vinson. Vinson was a handheld radio, used the Seville key generator, and there's a Vinson in the museum. If you ever get back east and see any of these things, you'll be surprised. It was a nice little handheld radio. It was pretty secure. The nice part about looking at a problem like Vinson was we had time to do it right. Seville was designed in the 50s, and it was evaluated until the late 60s, early 70s. Then it was implemented in Vinson, and then we continued to evaluate the implementation because the adversary is never going after the actual algorithm. They're going after the algorithm as it's implemented, and you have to understand that. The implementation is much more than just the algorithm. It's the whole system. And that, unfortunately, that also includes people. And people are always the weak link. But Seville, over time, it was neat. I was part of the evaluation team of Seville. It was great to be a crippy back then because cryptography ruled. Cryptography could actually protect communications. And we believe that that crypto is still pretty good. So when we looked at Vinson, what did we do? Well, we evaluated the logic for about 10 years to make sure that we couldn't think of anything that we could do against it. And it was really neat to work on that harder problem. When you were a crippy back then working on cryptography, the solutions, the things that you found were really hard science. They were things that you could give talks on, and people would study those talks and try to figure out what on earth you had done and how that might be applied to other problems. In today's world, when you look at the things that we find on modern communication systems, the stuff in general is not that hard science. The nice thing about cryptography is that we had a lot of time to really work on hard problems. In the 60s and 70s, you know, we were going after the hardest cryptographic problems in the world because we were going after the work of the best designers in the world. Those came from two places, came from Russia and came from the United States. Yeah, it was interesting working with those. There were only a couple of designers in both places, and they were really good. So one of the key aspects was geography, what you had to protect. So back in Greece, the geography meant how far could that messenger travel in delivering his message. But back when we got to World War II, geography was a much bigger problem. You could talk from Washington to Europe. You could talk throughout Europe down to Africa. You had to coordinate things. It was a much different problem. At the same time, it was a simple problem. When I had that handheld radio that I was evaluating, that handheld radio was going to be held by six people out in the field. And they were a little local net, and any problem only affected those six people. Now, if it was a problem with civilian general, there were lots of sixes all over the place. But in general, when you had a problem with a net, it was a minor impact, not like the connectedness that we have today. The concept of communication security is that you have information that somebody wants to get. So you have to worry about a threat adversary model, and that's the first thing. I see a lot of kids working at my lab today, and the first thing they start doing is throwing up an architecture. And that's not the first thing you need to do. The first thing you need to do is worry about, you're trying to protect information. What's your threat adversary model? What are you worried about? And then you develop a policy and an architecture to address those concerns. But you don't start off by throwing together an architecture. So let's look at a threat adversary model. And what are you worried about? Well, you're worried about resources first, capabilities, intent, motivation, risk aversion, and access. So resources. If you think about back in the 60s and 70s when we had the Cold War was basically split up into two pieces. One piece was espionage, and the other was a technology race. Technology race was two parts as well. They were related. It was the race for space, but also for nuclear weapons. So the nuclear weapon was the threat, and espionage was a game that was played between the two countries to make sure that we knew what their plans were with those nuclear weapons. So if you look at the Soviet Union at that point in time, what kind of resources did they have? They had a lot of money. They had a lot of smart people. They had all of the Russian technology at their fingertips because the Russian government controlled that. If you look at their capabilities, they basically knew what we did. They had a lot of scientists working on this problem, thousands of scientists working on that problem. Intent and motivation, this was the nice thing. Their intent and their motivation was very simple. They wanted our secrets because they wanted to know what we were planning to do against them. It was a very nice and very symmetric world. Now, their access. Access at that point in time was very interesting. It was more or less person to person and cipher. So when you were sending messages, well, I could send a message from here to Europe, the Russians would get the cipher. And they could play with that cipher all they wanted. In addition, they had people here in the United States that were acting as spies. So it was the spy game was person to person and cipher, a very simple game. And my job as a crippy was to make sure that they couldn't do anything to that cipher. Defense was expensive. If you looked at that Vinson, that was a pretty expensive little handheld radio. But offense was more expensive. And that's a very good game. If you think about what we did with the value, and you think about designing something in the 50s that's going to be fielded in the 70s and is still in use today, that's a very long time frame. So if you think about Moore's Law and what that means over time, how that tells you technology is going to improve, you have to be a little bit careful with Moore's Law, because when it tells you technology is going to improve, that's technology in general. But any specific problem that you have is not technology in general. It's a specific piece of technology. And different parts of technology will advance at different rates. It's driven by basically two things. Economics. People want to improve things that will mean they can sell more things. And the other is that there are actually technological limits that you reach where you can't improve things any faster than we were going. So back in the 60s, I had huge tape drives. And they didn't get any better over time, because basically nobody else but NSA was buying those tape drives. And we weren't big enough to really get people to spend a lot of money in improving them. So that was a game that the technology just didn't get any better, and we had to factor that into our calculations. Fascinating problem. So access was key. Now, risk aversion was a very interesting topic. Back in the 60s and 70s, if you think about the risk, we didn't want any of our spies getting caught. The Russians didn't want any of their spies getting caught. It gave you a black eye if you were caught spying on someone. In addition to that, a lot of the operations that we had in place were like having a gun with one bullet. You didn't want to waste that bullet. You wanted to use it at the right time, and you wanted it to be effective. The risk of losing an operation was important. So if you look at what happened with the U.S. and Russia, you go back about once a decade, we'd find something that the Russians had done. So one of the things we found was, say, Walker. Well, Walker was a spy, you know. We knew that our crypto was good. They weren't breaking our crypto, but they were reading messages. How were they doing that? Well, Walker was a crypto custodian. So he was actually selling the crypto variables to the Russians. And we know that we know they knew what the boxes looked like. Back in 76, when we first fielded Vinson, I had a buddy in the FBI who stopped by to see me one day and said, by the way, it's interesting, I think you'd like to know this. The Russians have put out an offer of $1 million for the first Vinson to be delivered to the Russian embassy. So I immediately went up and said, we should sell them one, because what the heck, you know they're going to get one. Before we could get it done, actually, the offer was pulled. They got one before we could get our act together. So you know that happens. But losing the crypto verbal was a critical piece. We were really worried about that. One of the interesting things about cryptography is that it's enabled by technology. So you can design crypto for lots of things, but the technology's got to be there to implement it. I remember in 1974, I was sitting at my desk one day, and I was working on trying to evaluate a logic. And I was actually making progress, and I was going to break this thing. It was going to take a couple months, but I knew I was going to get there. And the director of information assurance stopped by my desk, and I said, what are you working on? So I explained it to him. I explained that this was something that was a new type of logic that was actually going to be run in software rather than in hardware. And he said, okay, I don't want you spending any more than half a day a week on that, because we're never really going to implement cryptography in software. We just don't trust those things. And he was serious. He really was not going to allow it. So that was in 72. He retired in 73, and in 74 we implemented the first software cryptography. Sometimes that's the way things work. You have to replace people. And that's life. Yeah, I was downtown a couple months ago talking to a senior guy in the Department of Defense. This was before I retired, so it was a few months ago. And he said, you know, I have nuclear weapons. And actually, I knew that. So I said, yes, sir, I know that. And he said, you know, when I see one of these cyber attacks coming, if I have to, I'm going to use a nuclear weapon. Now, this is kind of scary, because this is a guy who actually does have nuclear weapons. And he's thinking he's going to see a cyber attack coming. I don't know, what does he think? It's like a missile, where here comes a string of ones and zeros through the air? Let's track back and see where it's coming from. Oh, yeah. So I said to him, so, sir, what are you going to do when it looks like it's coming from Ohio? And he crooked his head and started looking up. And I'm thinking, this guy's thinking. That was supposed to be a joke, and he's thinking about it. What's he thinking? Is he thinking that why is Ohio attacking the Pentagon? Or is he thinking, you know, if I take out Ohio, that sends a good message to the world? Either way, you don't want this guy to have a nuclear weapon in his fingertips. But that's where you are in this world. People are too important a part of any system. So when we're looking at Vinson, I spent about 20 years evaluating civil logic over time. And I didn't get anywhere, by the way. That's one of the neat things about crypto. You don't always get anywhere. So in 20 years, we evaluated the logic. We also evaluated the implementation to make sure nothing bad could happen. Because when you're evaluating crypto, you have to know what the design, you have to know it better than the designer. You can't get anywhere if you don't. You have to know what the designer is planning for it to do. You have to know what it's going to do that might be different than what the designer's planning. And you have to know what you can make it do that's still different than that. So we took the engineering diagrams from Vinson. Now, Vinson was old, so it was made of gates and register stages. We went through and we failed every input and every output mentally of the gates and the register stages. It took about 6 months to go through and figure out everything that could happen bad to that Seville, to that implementation of Seville, to that Vinson. We looked at it, and everything bad we fixed before we put it out in the field. And if we couldn't fix it, we alarmed it. So if it happened bad, it would shut off. Because we took it really seriously. We knew the Russians were going to throw everything they had at that logic. And we didn't want to compromise the security of that communication. Can you imagine trying to do that today with say, an operating system? 50 million lines, 60 million lines. You're going to fix everything before you field it? Not in my lifetime. It's just not going to happen. The other interesting thing about that Vinson is, remember, it was designed in the 50s. It was actually, the final implementation was put in 75. Oh, by the way, here's how careful we were with that implementation. We built it in Camden, New Jersey, so we didn't make any of the chips on Tuesdays. And I assume you guys are West Coast? Okay. So Camden, New Jersey is the home of Campbell's Soup. And on Tuesdays of the day, they make tomato soup. So you have to worry about, did you ever make lasagna and wrap it up in aluminum foil? 2 days later, you see the tomatoes eaten through. There are problems with chips, with that tomato acid. So we didn't make any Vinson chips on Tuesdays. That's how careful we were. Vinson was fielded in the 70s. It hasn't changed. We believe it's still secure. The neat thing about Vinson is it's got the configuration control really simple. It's got an on-off switch. It's got plain cipher. So as long as you're in cipher, on-off, it's secure either way. Now, your laptop, you know, it's got an on-off switch. If you put it off, it's secure. If you put it on, it's not. If you've got a cell phone or a PDA, it's got an on-off switch. If you turn it off, it's not secure. If you turn it on, it's not secure. So things haven't gotten better. I've got a lot of things we know about the Russians, because I've got a buddy. His name is Viktor Shamov. He was the director of information assurance in the 70s for the KGB. So he, you know, free agency in sports. He came over in 1980, joined our team. Welcome addition. We needed a guy with his expertise. So I worked with him for a few years. It's been fun. Every once in a while, he's retired, I'm retired. But we get together about once a month and eat crab cakes, and we talk about the good old days when it was just them and us. And yeah, we don't talk a lot about what we did to each other, but there's some undertones there of what we used to do. One of the neat things we talk about is the honor among spies that there was back then, that there was a line in the sand. And you knew that no one was going beyond that line. So I wasn't worried about the Russians coming and kidnapping me or anything like that. What I was worried about was the Russians taking advantage of our people. And that means, I'm going to talk a little bit about that tomorrow, life as a target. But you didn't want to give them that opportunity. The idea of honor among spies, I think is really an important concept. We knew what the rules were. We knew what the Russians would do. And we knew that they wouldn't go outside those rules. So if you were over in Moscow, you knew you were safe. Moscow was the one city that I felt no problems walking around, because there were three guys in front of me. I didn't know which three guys they were. And there were three guys behind me, and I didn't know which three they were. But I knew nobody was going to get it within 6 feet of me, because they didn't want me talking to anybody. So you could just go anywhere. It's great. On the other hand, I did send a team over there in the 80s. And they were going to do some work at the embassy. They were over there as NSA people. And so they got together in a hotel room the first night there. And they were going to talk about the schedule for the next day and where they were going to have dinner. So they'd been together for about 5 minutes, and there was a knock on the door. And there was a guy from the hotel, and he said, I brought you a copying machine in case you want to make a copy of something. He brought it in, plugged it in. No. When's the last time you're in a hotel and somebody brought you a copy? This is a great hotel, but nobody brought me a copying machine last night. And so luckily, my guys were engineers. They knew exactly what to do to counter this problem. They unplugged it. And then they took a blanket off the bed and covered it up just to, you know, defense in layers. And 10 minutes later, there was a knock on the door. And it's the same guy from the hotel with a copying machine. He said, I brought you a new copying machine. That one's not working. That's the kind of thing that happens. But that was within the rules. So you knew that. It's an interesting life. So you get about once a decade, you get a problem like that. You know, we had Walker, where he was selling crypto variables. Vincent addressed that by using over-the-air rekeying. And it didn't use an RSA-type system, because you couldn't use RSA in that technology. In fact, I was talking to our best designer. When the UK was first developing the asymmetric, the public key, and I asked him what he thought of it. He said, it's a cute idea, but why waste your time working on something like that that'll never be used? And it wasn't possible to really do that in 60s and 70s technology. Once we got into microprocessors, yeah, then it was cool. In fact, before about 1970, we were using analog speech. And the way we sent that was you'd take a speech signal, chop it up into pieces like a jigsaw puzzle, scramble them, and send the message out, and then it would put it back together on the other end. That's, if you've ever done a jigsaw puzzle, you know that that's not real secure, because you can put those pieces back together. So the question is, how fast can you put it back together? And that's a risk management decision. And you always make those. Everything we do is a risk management decision. When we fielded Vincent, it was a risk management decision, because you're taking a risk that the guy's going to actually put it in cipher instead of leaving it in plain text. Second of all, you're taking a risk that you might have missed something. You know, there's no guarantee that we have all the smartest people in the world working on this stuff. But we had the luxury of time. We did get to spend 10 years on it before we did anything. And that was because we had no competition. there was no commercial IA out there. And the reason for that was we were the only people that were using it, U.S. government. So when our people wanted something, we got to define what functionality they got and what implementation they got, then they got to use it. Then some bad things happened. A couple of bad things happened. Some of you might think they're not quite as bad as that, but the first bad thing that happened was that NIST decided that there was a need for a public algorithm. So that was DES. Now what happened? They came to NSA and they said, would you make us one? And we said, if we make you one, nobody will use it because they won't trust us. It was true. They wouldn't have trusted us. So they decided to have a public contest to see who would do it. They put a call out for algorithms. The first time they put a call out, they got three applicants. All three were looking for grants for developing a logic, and that's not what they were looking for. They really were looking for a final product. So they came back to us and they said, what do you think? Now, we had talked to IBM, and IBM was working on something. And we said, why don't you talk to them? So they did. They talked to IBM, and they convinced them to put Lucifer in as a potential data encryption standard. They put out another call, and they got three more. One was another application for a grant. One was an algorithm that really wasn't very good, and one was Lucifer. So Lucifer went out for public scrutiny. That was very interesting. So that was the first bad thing that happened. It wasn't the need for DES, but it was the fact that, see, NSA had built its crypto ability by having the best problems to work on and having a group of people that were together. We had 1,000 mathematicians working on the problems, and we could communicate across those 1,000. That's a critical mass that's huge. When you're working on ideas, it's important to have 1,000 people you can talk to. Now, you didn't talk to all of them, but you knew the ones you wanted to talk to. And so when DES went out, it gave the world a problem to look at. The other bad thing that happened was the internet, because that allowed the people on the outside to get a virtual critical mass of thousands of people they could communicate with. And again, they didn't communicate with 1,000 people, but they got to choose who they were communicating with. Very important. Now, another bad thing that happened. When we looked at DES, we evaluated it. One of the things we saw, if you're familiar with DES, it's got these little S boxes. There are permutations on the number 0 through 15. When you look at those permutations, permutations on the numbers 0 through 15 are going to look funny. It's like looking at a baseball player's at bats over the years. You're going to see streaks, and it looks like it's streaky because the human eye tends to find non-random and random. So permutations on the numbers 0 through 15, you're always going to find funny things in those permutations. The problem with DES was we knew of differential cryptanalysis. And so there were 8 criteria that we had used to generate the S boxes. And NSA had a 9th criteria that essentially blocked differential cryptanalysis. So when IBM sent that to us, we looked at it and we figured how good are these S boxes? They weren't good enough. They didn't block the stuff. So we had to replace them with S boxes that would block it. So when they got it back, they said, this is a change. And it was a change. The world knew that there was a change, and so the world figured that we had put a back door in these S boxes. Now, this was the best thing that could have happened to us. Right? Because the one concern NSA had was that the world was going to start using DES and we weren't going to be able to read it. So when everybody was afraid that we had put a trap door in it, that was cool because that meant people were afraid to use it. And Then, of course, you know, Behnam and Shamir found the attack quite a bit later. I think it was about 1990 that they actually found that. One of the you're familiar with that? It was that they had looked at Field first, and they saw this differential analysis thing, and then they went back and they figured, well, you know, let's look at these S boxes. And so there was a lot of work done proving that these weren't random S boxes. Based on the 8 criteria that were published, that's true, they weren't. Based on the 9th, they were. They went back and they regenerated a bunch of sets of random S boxes on the 8 public criteria. And they applied differential cryptanalysis to DES, and they found that it worked on every one of those random sets of S boxes. So they said, and this was pretty neat. They actually nailed it in their paper. They said there was a 9th criteria that blocked this, must have been something like this, and they said that when we thought they had introduced a trapdoor, what they had actually done was blocked this attack, which is actually exactly right. I remember I was sitting with Adi Shamir at dinner a couple years ago, and he pulled out a laptop and showed me all the correspondence he had with people around the world as they were applying differential cryptanalysis to DES. And it was fun to read that old stuff. Who the heck goes, who carries that stuff to dinner with them? But Adi does, apparently. But we had a fun time talking about it. Yeah, he had another neat thing. He gave a talk and he flashed up. He had sent what we typically refer to as a nut letter. Because I get a lot of letters from people. When I was at NSA, I used to get a lot of letters from people who had the great new idea. And most of the time, they're not so great. You get compression schemes that where a guy says, I can compress 40,000 bits to 1. And I'm thinking, oh, that's pretty good. So I talked to the guy, and he says, yep, I can do it. And I said, well, you know, if you got a short message, you're going to compress it down to like 1 bit. You have a few of those 40,000 bit messages that compress to 1 bit. How do you go back the other way? He says, I store the information in the magic zap space. And I think, yeah, okay, that's good. That's very good. But every once in a while you get a letter like this one, and Adi had sent some ideas in, and the director sent them to me, and so I analyzed it, and they were good ideas. And so I wrote a nice letter back thanking him, telling him what was good about it. Of course, I didn't get to sign the letter. The director signed it and sent it out. And Adi flashed this up on the screen, said, I got this letter from the director of NSA. And I'm thinking, yeah, if only you knew, the director probably didn't even read it. but that's life. So that DES, that was a huge change, because suddenly there was a need for crypto outside of the DOD. And that put a strain on us, because there was suddenly commercial was coming out. How do you evaluate commercial stuff? So prior to then, we had had a two-element assurance model. It had intrinsic insurance and extrinsic insurance. We designed it right. We had people whose whole job was design security. And we built it right. We had lines that didn't work on Tuesdays because we were worried about Tuesdays. They were only used for our stuff. Everybody who was on those lines had clearances. Now that you got to take with a grain of salt, because how many spies can you name? I can name about a half dozen. One of the interesting characteristics is that they're all U.S. citizens who had top secret clearances. Right. So I mean that's a problem. But still, you do what you can do. Those days were gone with DES. And of course, you have people again. We made that stuff really easy for people to use. DES wasn't quite as easy. I remember we were talking to a big bank one time, and this is just one of those things that makes you want to go home and cry. I'm talking to the head of security for the bank. And he's pointing out, this is where we use DES, and this is where we use DES, and this is where we use DES. So I said, that's pretty cool. What's your key management scheme? He said, That's the good news. We don't need a key management scheme because it came with key. Now, that's scary. The other scary thing is he was apparently talking to other people. Right? So that's life. I was out here on the West Coast about 10 years ago talking to a vice president of a big company. And he was vice president of research. And it was a one-on-one. We were having a pretty good time, joking around. About 45 minutes into it, he reached over and he whacked me. He whacked me hard on the knee. He said, "You know, you information assurance guys are a pain in the ass." I said, "It's my job." And he said, "Yeah, the only good thing about you guys is no matter what kind of security you guys put in place, my guys are smart enough to get around it." And you know that's true. There's a lot of that that goes on. I see that as well. One of the things you have to do with your security policy, your rules, you have to make sure that the people understand why those rules are there. If you saw Buckshot Yankee a couple years ago, one of our problems is that our new soldiers are too smart. They're too familiar with this modern technology. So when we gave them a series of 10 steps of things they had to do with those thumb drives, they knew they didn't really need to do all 10, that they could skip several of them and it wouldn't impact anything except, of course, security. But it did save them a little time, and that's what cost us. It's those risk management decisions that'll kill you. You do have to live with that. Now, after DES, the world did change. There's a lot of commercial crypto out there. One of the bad things of that is it has functionality that people will want to use. Functionality is opportunity for the adversary. The adversary is going to take advantage of that, and he's going to use it. Vincent, I got to study for 10 years. Hasn't changed since 1976. You look at stuff today, gets patched every Tuesday. We used to talk to, back in the 80s, we used to talk to people, to companies, and sometimes you get little companies to come in and say, "We want to tell you something that's wrong with your product." And they say, no, don't. If you tell me, I've got to fix it. Luckily, the big companies didn't react that way. The big companies said, boy, do we want to talk to you, because anything you tell us, we can fix. And we'd much rather get it from you than read it in the paper or get blindsided by it. And that was great. We were happy to do that. They wanted to know how much time we wanted before we were going to go public with it. We were never going public with anything we found, because we've got people that won't patch. And it's not that at home I patch. But there are people on the front lines that have systems that have to be up constantly. They can't take the time to patch, and they can't take the risk that something's going to go wrong. And I understand that. That's a big deal. And so that's just something we have to live with. And I'm not going to tell anybody that there's a problem with one of those systems, because those are the guys that are vulnerable. Well, you know, one of the best things you can do is we've put some things in front lines that reduce time of information flow from minutes to seconds. And when you're walking down a street in the Mideast and there's a car 50 yards up the street, you'd much rather know in 10 seconds whether there's anything there than in 10 minutes, because 10 minutes is too long. Those kind of things are important. So we want to make sure we have that functionality for the troops. We want to make sure it's secure. And the problem you have in today's world is this interconnectedness is killer. So if you look at the 70s and the 60s, Russia was the adversary, because they were the only ones who could afford to build a special purpose equipment to go after the crypto. They were the ones that had the social network to get the spies. About every 10 years, you see one of these things happen. You see Walker happen. You see gunmen happen. Are you familiar with gunmen? Anybody who doesn't believe in the life cycle threat, the supply chain, we pulled all of our equipment out of the embassy in Moscow, brought it back and x-rayed it. Are you familiar with typewriters? Okay, under the keyboard, there's a triangular stability bar. So the Russians had replaced all of those stability bars with stability bars made out of the same thing but hollowed out with a recorder and a transmitter in it. The way we did stuff over in the embassy was we had offline encryption. So people would type out a message. It would go down, it would get encrypted, and then it would be transmitted. So offline encryption, really safe. You can't go after that. The transmission, we know it's cipher, really safe. But if you can get to the typewriter where that message is being typed out, they were getting the information before we were. That's life. That's gunmen. That's the kind of thing that happens. And then of course, we had the one in the State Department, which I assume you're all familiar with that, where they took the chair rail out and put a new one in, new piece of chair rail with a recording device. I got to tell you, I've been to a lot of meetings in the State Department. They weren't getting much. Yeah, I hope that's not being recorded. But anyway, you know how they caught the guy who was doing that? It was interesting. A D.C. policeman saw him, and he was doing something very, very strange. First of all, he was sitting in a car outside the State Department. That's a little bit strange, but that's not what he caught him for. He was putting quarters in the parking meter. And Russians never do that. They have diplomatic immunity. There's one guy that has 30,000 parking tickets. I don't know how do you get 30,000 parking tickets? It's like he must drive around behind a policeman hoping to get a ticket. But so he's got 30,000 parking tickets. But this guy was putting quarters in the machine. So he watched him, and he kept playing with a box of Kleenex in the back seat. So he called the FBI, and they looked, and the recording device was in the box of Kleenex. And that kind of thing happens. So about once a decade, you get these things with a Walker. Martin and Mitchell. Martin and Mitchell were interesting. You may not have heard of them. They were NSA guys who defected from the research organization. That was quite a while ago. So it's about once a decade that you have these things. Now, in today's world, we've really had to change. We're going to commercial products. That's the way we are. And information assurance is still an important aspect of that, not only for us, but for everybody else who's using it. So how are you going to think that you have security there? Well, you still want to try to build it right. Where is it being built? You know, it's software. It's all over the world. Bad things do happen. We found intentional bugs. We know they're intentional. You can tell just by looking at the code. A lot of times, if you see the code and it doesn't match the documentation, you know something's gone wrong. Somebody's trying to lead you astray. So you find that. We've found files that aren't supposed to be there. That's kind of weird. We've found open source stuff where we've talked to the people who posted it, and they say that's not the code that I posted. So somebody fixed it for them. And you know, they'll point to the bad parts as being additions. That's not so good. You see that all the time. So you can still try to evaluate stuff, but with patches, remote maintenance, you'd have to be evaluating it every week, and you can't do that. So you'd like it to be good, but you don't have the same confidence in that intrinsic security that you did. Extrinsic, evaluate it. You don't have 20 years to evaluate this stuff. It's going out. It's already out. If you look at our NIAP, our Common Criteria Evaluation, where we do evaluate commercial things, the interesting thing is that we've evaluated a large number of commercial products. None of them have been available for purchase when we finished the evaluation. They've all been changed. Yeah, they've been patched. There's a new version out because it takes a year and a half. They're just not the same. As far as having source code, you know, what are you going to do with that much source code? It's hard. It can be helpful, but having that source code, running a lot of tools, it's been a lot of neat work on commercial tools that can look for problems. I think it was the University of Wisconsin did some fascinating work that said one of the things about the commercial tools is that they all find different problems, but they're all from the same family, and there are families of problems that aren't found. You do need to have people looking as well as machines. So that's important. But those two are not enough. So we've added two more elements of the assurance model. One is configuration and maintenance. It's implementation security, where you really need to keep it up to date. You need to patch. You need to monitor. You need to go in there and look at the logs, make sure that you're doing things. I talk to people all the time that you ask them about those logs, and they never look at them. What good is it if you're not looking at it? You're going to find something. You know, you find you've been had for a year. You go back and see when it started. Yeah, that's good. And that's the kind of thing you find. I think it's about 7% of the intrusions that are found have been in place for over a year. We had one where some country was in, and again, you don't know whether it's the nation state or an individual or some other nation state pretending to be that nation state, but somebody was in, and they were in so deep that we had to just shut down the system and clean it out. About a week later, we thought it was all rebuilt, brought it back up, and an hour later, everything was back. It's hard. So the fourth layer that we've added is the hunt layer. It says you've got to understand that the first three layers aren't enough to keep you safe. You've got to go in there constantly and look for the adversary. Try to identify anything that looks funny. And that's really important. It's also really hard. Those four layers, that's where we are. If you think about how interesting it was when it was just us and the Russians, and that was a good life. We were going up against the best. And it was really hard problems. The problems are simple today. I was talking to one of my friends who's a computer security guy. He's actually the best attack guy I know. And I was telling him, let me backstep for just a second. Back when we first started looking at commercial crypto stuff, we used to do counts as one of our metrics. It's a terrible metric, but we used to do counts because you can't count things. So we'd count the attacks that we found, the crypto attacks that we found, and we were counting the signal attacks that we found, Tempest type stuff. And we would report that up to the front office. And we do it every 3 months, and we'd come up with two or three in each one of those cases. And not always big ones. But then when we started counting the CompuSec the first month, I got a 2 and I got a 3 from the crypto guys and the signals guys, and then I got 1,504 from the software people. And, you know, that's out of whack. And I said, well, how do you get so many? And they said, well, it's easy. You go in, you say, let's find one here today. And you go in and you look at that code, and there it is. It's just not hard. And so I was talking to this really good guy, and I was saying, you know, I have to really bust to find something. Sometimes it takes me 2 or 3 years to find something on a logic. You're going after low-hanging fruit. He said, nah, I'm not going after low-hanging fruit. The software developers, they're picking the fruit, packaging it, putting it in a box, and leaving it there for me. I'm just picking it up off the ground. He might be right in some cases. But it is a very different game, and we are all in that situation, and that's a huge change. It's a huge change. How many countries do you think Super Bowl was broadcast live to? Okay, to 235 last year, plus the U.S. Of those 235, how many have agreed not to spy on us? 4. I think that all 235 have lived up to their agreements. It's very interesting. Anybody can get in the game. If you go back to that threat adversary model, resources, what does it take to run an attack? It takes a laptop. It might take you $50 to buy a zero day somewhere, but but you know, you might just be able to get the script off something too. How many attacks? This is not pings, but how many attacks on the U.S. government systems last year? 41,000. That's a pretty good number. That's a lower bound, by the way, because those are the ones we saw. And there might be some we didn't see, didn't recognize. But we saw 41,000. That's pretty big. Now, if you look, it's not just the U.S. government. Information assurance is about information. Who has information? It turns out everybody does. When it was the Russians were going after U.S. government strategy because we were the threat to them. To other countries, life has changed. It's very different. So what are they going after? Basically four pieces. They're going after personal information because that's worth money. You know that stock scheme that worked so well? You're familiar with that? This is kind of a cool scheme. If you have a 401k, you know it's easy to buy stock, but it's very hard to get money out of the 401k. So the guy was looking for stocks that weren't trading very often, were very stable in price, and when they came up for sale, he'd buy them. So he bought a bunch of stock at $3 a share. And after he'd amassed 10,000 shares, he'd put in a sell order at $4 a share, and then he'd use somebody's 401k information to put in a buy order at $4 a share. So he'd make a 33% profit on his stock. And they caught him, tried to put him on trial. His government claimed that was too important a part of their economy to make it illegal. So he's free. That's when you look at the international aspect of this. I remember we had a Secretary of State one time who said, what we need to do is get all the countries of the world together and agree that this is going to be a crime and we won't permit it. Yeah. I think the chances of that happening are relatively small, considering that all of those governments are actually participating. Because they are. You know, all of those governments are participating. Right, I mean, Stuxnet was not some high school. I don't know who it was, but I guarantee it wasn't some high school. Much as that would have been a good project. So what's going to happen? Where are we, and what are we going to do? We got to get better. You've got people are targets, companies are targets. Government is now two types of targets. There's still the strategic Department of Defense, Department of State information that countries want. But there's also information that someone like NASA has. If a country is trying to build a space program of their own, they might want the NASA results. I remember somebody was talking about China's space program looks remarkably like ours did over the years, except they didn't make any of the mistakes that we made. And I don't know, if you borrow a terabyte of information, it might help. I don't know what you do with a terabyte of information, by the way. That's a whole lot of stuff. But if you've got a whole lot of people, maybe you can do something with it. The other interesting aspect of information is there's so much information out there, but a lot of it is duplication. They said they did a study last year, 90% of the emails were considered spam by the recipients. I'm surprised it was actually that low. I thought it'd be much higher because mine's, almost everything I get at work I consider spam, and most of the stuff I get at home is spam. But that's where we are. And now, you know, we still have a Cold War going on, and one of the real problems with the Cold War is that it's changed. It used to be nuclear weapons and espionage. And now it's cyber. And cyber is used for both. And that has changed the symmetry. Because people without the resources can now be active participants in that game. And that's a very dangerous situation. The other problem is that the symmetry of the Soviet Union and the United States meant that they wanted to know if we were going to strike first. We wanted to know if they were going to strike first. Nobody wanted the other party to strike first, but nobody wanted anybody to strike. Nobody wanted a nuclear war. With cyber, there are people out there that have the capability to do cyber that don't care if somebody strikes first. Right, if a terrorist group takes down a power grid, what's your response? You're going to take down their power grid? They don't have one. You know, China and Russia, they don't want to do anything to our financial system because they go down with us. We're all too interconnected. But a terrorist, hey, that might be fun. That's a serious situation. The other serious aspect of this is there's this business model where security is expensive. And so you look at the power companies, you look at the lobbies, you saw that the legislation was just defeated because the companies didn't want to have to pay for security. What's it going to take for these companies to realize that this is a significant problem? Yeah, I'm really disappointed in that. I remember talking to a bunch of senators last year. I was sitting in a room with about 8 senators, and every one of them was adamant that we had to get this legislation through. And it was not. I don't know which senators are in which party. I'm sorry, it's one of those things. I'm not a big political guy, so I don't know. But I guarantee you, it was most of a committee, so it had to be people from both parties, and every one of them was supporting the bill. And yet it fails. The lobbies are so powerful. It's really a problem. The other problem is that where are you going to go for the capabilities to fix things? The government is not well aligned with authorities and capabilities. Times have changed. The authorities are really old. If you look at the authorities for CIA and NSA, they talk about CIA has authority for information at rest, and NSA has authority for information in motion. Well, that's from the old days where you had teletypes and it printed out on paper. So NSA gets the stuff as it's going through the air. After it's printed out on paper and put in a safe, CIA gets it out of the safe. That's not today's world, and the authorities haven't changed. How do you tell information at rest from information in motion these days? It's rest, motion. Doesn't mean anything. Really doesn't mean anything. The good news is that the agencies realize that and they can work together on things. But the bad news is it's not as effective when you have to do that. It'd be more effective if you could actually align the authorities with the capabilities to try to solve some of the problems we have. The big problem, of course, is when you're dealing with information assurance and you're dealing with implementations, you have people involved in every aspect. You have people that are writing the code. You have people that are looking for holes in the code. You have people that are going to take shortcuts, that are going to take risks. It all comes down to people. About 6 years ago, I used to go out and tell people that we really need to educate the end user, that there's a problem out there. That's been done. It's been done to death. The end user understands that there's a problem out there. The end user doesn't know how to solve that problem. What are they going to do? What we've got to do, the cyber professionals, we've got to create tools that are invisible to those end users that protect them. It's up to us. It's up to the next generation of bright young kids out there to solve this problem, because my generation's not going to do it. Admiral Studeman had a conference about a year ago that I went to, and they had 25 talks on things that were going to solve the problem. The Admiral himself said for $5 billion, he could solve 80% of the problems. I don't know what solving 80% of the problems. Where'd he get that? Does he know 100% of the problems? Does he get the right 80% of the problems? I told him that was kind of a stupid comment. He didn't think much of that. Wow. But he's retired, now I'm retired, doesn't really matter. But at the end, I said, you know, this is familiar. So I went back over my notes. I heard those same guys talking 15 years ago with the same ideas. You know, they didn't work 15 years ago. They aren't going to work today. We got to get some bright kids in there with some new ideas of how we take this on and how we actually address this challenge, how we protect this country. That was the neat thing about crypto 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. Crypto was powerful enough that it really could do a decent job of protecting the communications. The reason was the stuff was so simple that nobody could do anything to it. It's a radio. It's got an on-off switch. You turn it on and you talk. There's not much that an adversary can do. He can't send anything to it to change that. All he can do is send a garbage that doesn't, it sounds like noise. Today's world is very different. That functionality, it makes it so easy for the adversary to get in, and they can manipulate you. The other thing that's dangerous is that risk management. All the users make risk management decisions. We all make them all the time, right? Everything you do in life is a risk management decision, right? You eat dinner at night. You're going to complain about the food. Risk management decision. More than that, you go to cross the street. You look and see you've got a light. You're going to walk across the street. Risk management decision. Because there are cars that will run that light. If you think about a forward observer, he's got two things he's got to do. He's got to stay alive and he's got to complete the mission. Everything else is risk management. And yet that forward observer, he's got a laptop, it's connected to the Pentagon. And every time he makes a risk management decision, he shares that decision with guys downtown. And they don't even know that they're sharing it. Same thing is true at home, if you've got kids. I was talking to Scott Charney, who's vice president in charge of vulnerability mitigation for Microsoft. And we used to talk about how we got to educate the user. And he said, I was talking to him a couple of years ago, and he said, you know, you're right, that idea we had, that was really dumb. He said, I'm in a sandwich generation right now. I've got a four-year-old. He loves to use the computer. He looks at videos. He laughs, looks at animal pictures. Every once in a while, a little screen pops up in the middle of his picture. He can't read. He's only four. But he knows if he clicks OK, he gets to look at his picture. So he clicks OK. Right? He said, my mother just retired. She was a biology professor. She travels all over the country, all over the world. Every time she's planning a trip, she looks at what's at museums, what's at shows, what kind of shopping there is, what kind of tourist attractions. Every once in a while, one of these screens pops up in the middle of her planning. He said, so he watched her. He said, she starts reading it. She gets closer and closer to the screen. She reads it for about 2 minutes. Then she shrugs and hits OK. Because she knows it's saying something, but she doesn't know what she can do about it. And she's going on a trip. He said, you know, we're never going to educate the four-year-old or the 80-year-old. It's just not going to happen. You're not going to make them smart enough that they can beat the Russians. So we've got to do that for them. That's our job. And that's the state of information assurance. We're no longer protecting the Department of Defense. We're protecting the country because it's the country that's now the target, the whole country. And I've got plenty of time for questions if anybody wants to ask anything. And that was just about an hour with no watch management.
Hi, great yes. Talk. I very much enjoyed. So you talked about Lucifer and how the S-boxes were changed, and I remember living through that, and that was all fun.
It was great, wasn't it?
It was so great. And one of the other things, the other main thing, of course, that was changed between Lucifer and DES was the key size.
Yes.
That shrank down to 56 bits. Is there anything interesting, funny you can say about that?
Yeah, I can say a lot of things about that. First of all, let me say that this was all classified until, I believe it was 2010. I was having dinner with Art Coviello, and it was the 20th anniversary, 20th or 30th anniversary of the RSA conference was coming up. And he said, I'd like to have a good talk. And I said, how about if I get the DES story declassified? So I got it declassified for RSA. And it was time. I wanted an excuse to get that story declassified because I was the last guy at NSA who had worked on it. And it was going to die. The story was going to die if we didn't get it out. There was going to be nobody to tell it. So, yeah, 56. I lost my thing. Yeah, 56 was chosen very carefully. It was chosen for two reasons. We had an agreement with NIST that we would evaluate the algorithm and we would make sure that the algorithm had exactly as much, at least as much strength as the advertised strength. And you're familiar with the Behan and Shamir work that shows that DES is about 56 bits of strength. If we had 128 bits of crypto variable in there, it still would have been about 56 bits of strength. So we did some serious work and looked at what our threat adversary model was. We looked at how long we expected DES to be used with that threat adversary model. And we calculated that if we told NIST they could use it till 1990, 56 bits would be adequate. We could live up to our agreement about it being as strong as advertised, whereas if we'd gone out with 128, it wouldn't have been. So we came up with that agreement between the people that were in charge at the time. I was not in. There were a lot of the conversations I was not in on, but as developing this talk, I got to see a lot of notes that. And let me tell you another story about DES. There were a lot of teams working on this, and a lot of people didn't know anybody else was working on it. I was when I was doing this talk, I was talking to my best friend, a guy I worked with every day, and it turned out he was on a team that I didn't know existed that was working on DES when I was evaluating DES. But they had a lot of different independent teams working it to make sure we didn't miss anything. And then I went back, and he actually had some notes from meetings with the guy who was the lead information assurance guy, one-on-ones with the director, where they went over this to decide what was the right amount. And the director said, you got to tell me how much I need and how much I can get away with and still be honest. And so they told him 56 is going to be honest, and it's only going to take out to 1990. So that was the story. And I'll tell you, if you ask 12 people, you get 12 different stories about where it came from. But those are the notes from a meeting with the director where he made the decision, and they were background for the memo that he signed that said 56 bits. So I got to believe that that's somewhat accurate. There are other interesting stories. If you think of the, I spent about 15 minutes talking to Hellman, and he was, why didn't you change the key schedule? We had an agreement with NIST that we wouldn't change things we didn't have to change. I spent 2 years trying to attack that key schedule, and there was two very frustrating years because it looked simple enough that it had to be breakable. I couldn't get anywhere, and there's this whole idea of, you don't want to make things too complicated because you might miss a problem. And so if you can keep it simple, evaluate it, and don't find a problem, keep it simple. And that's why we didn't change the key schedule.
Great. I think you've been waiting a while, and then we'll come over to that.
Thank you. I'm Doug Roberts with RTI International. I also enjoyed your talk very much. I wonder if we could go back to Stuxnet for a minute, which you said would make a great high school project. I agree. But that's an interesting piece of code. If you've studied it and read the reports on it, maybe you've seen classified versions. I have not. But the consensus opinion seems to be that Stuxnet was sufficiently sophisticated and complex and targeted that it had to have been sponsored by a state or states. I wonder if you'd say a few words about that.
It really is sophisticated. It was very carefully crafted so that it, You know, if you think back to the Morris worm, the problem with the Morris worm was that he thought he could control it, and he couldn't, and it went wild. Stuxnet was very carefully crafted so that it would only impact its target. It really was a nice piece of work. I'll tell you, I'm used by NSA to talk to the press quite a bit. I'm still used. And so I've made it a personal choice not to look at any classified reports on anything in that area. So I'm with you on that. But I have read all the unclassified stuff. It certainly would seem to me that it takes a team that's spending a lot of time to do it that carefully. Now, there are some really good private individuals who could do stuff, but why would they? Yeah. Occam's razor says, yeah, that's a nation state, or a group of nation states working together, don't know.
You don't care to get any more specific than that?
Well, I can't, because I don't know anything. Okay. I don't know who did it, and I've intentionally not tried to find out so that I can be honest when I answer questions like that. I hate giving people I know, but I can't tell you type answers. I'd much rather tell you, hey, good news, I don't know.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay.
So, Matt Blaze, University of Pennsylvania. I really enjoyed your talk. A follow-on to Ian's question about DES. One of the side effects of DES was not just giving the world a strong cipher with that worked at its advertised strength, but through NSA's involvement, it effectively taught the world indirectly about this incredibly powerful cryptanalytic technique, differential cryptanalysis. Coppersmith apparently was able to, and the IBM team were able to reverse engineer what the attack was from NSA's changes. I think they called it the tickle attack later on, and then it eventually became Shamir's differential cryptanalysis. Surely the NSA must have anticipated that that would also be in effect, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the process that went on in agreeing to provide advice that would have this side effect of strengthening public crypto.
Yeah, you're exactly right. That was one of the big concerns that we had going in before we even knew what was going to happen. Before we knew that IBM was going to be the choice, when we first talked to NIST, we didn't want to put anything out that would educate the world, so we didn't want to put an algorithm out there. We didn't think that anybody would use it if we did. So we had to say no, but we also knew that if NIST was going to propose a standard that was going to protect the U.S. banking system, that we were the people that were best capable of evaluating that algorithm. We did understand that there was a risk that we would find something. The bad situation would have been it went out there and everybody evaluated and said it was fine, and we'd have to go in and say, no, it's got an attack. And at least in this case, we just modified it a little bit. But if we had to tell people, no, you can't use it because it's got a serious attack, then that would have been a worse situation. We knew that. It's one of those risk management decisions that you take. And that was laid out in the notes behind the director's decisions, that this was something we understood that we were, however we participated in this, we were going to be telling the world something. One thing that might have happened, somebody might have put something in and we evaluated it and said it was good, and somebody on the outside might have said they had an attack on it, and we might have to explain why it wasn't an attack. And that also would have been educational. So there were lots of risks. It's just a part of the changing life that we are going to be taking that. We became a more open agency. And if you saw the National Geographic documentary, they took people through 6 months of NSA. They were there for 6 months filming, and that's something that had never happened before, but it's because we are becoming more public. It's more important to tell people what is going on and to tell people what the issues are.
Yeah, so I actually look forward to the public crypto community getting the same lessons from Skipjack, which you know was published. You know,
there's nothing
15 years ago.
Yeah, there's nothing in Skipjack. That was designed to not be educational for anyone. In fact, that was the first criteria that we had, and we brought a team of outside people in, showed it to them, and one of the things that we were hoping was they'd say, this is a piece of crap. And they didn't say it was a piece of crap, but they said, this is the most uninteresting algorithm we've ever seen. I don't think anybody's getting anything out of Skipjack. But at the same time, it was as advertised. It didn't extend the state of the art. I don't think there's anything in Skipjack that the good people on the outside didn't already know. I hope I'm right, too.
Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Hi, Stefan Savage, UC San Diego. Very interesting talk. I'm wondering if we could return to Stuxnet for a second. I'm actually not interested in talking about who wrote Stuxnet.
Okay.
There's a different aspect of it that I think is interesting. So earlier on, you talked about honor among spies and the line and the importance of a threat model and so forth. And I'm wondering if you could comment about your sense of where that line is vis-a-vis Stuxnet, now that we have public demonstration of physical side effects through computational attacks that seems like they have ramifications in a lot of different spaces, and if there is an honor among cyber spies today, or if that's kind of an open field.
Yeah, I'll give you a little history on that. Back in the 70s, I worked very, very closely with the SIGINT community on problems. I was brought in to look at logics, to look at things, and I was not allowed to know certain things. Like, I wasn't allowed to know what country or who the target was or anything like that. I was given a problem, but not that information. And this was back before you got software. So I would get papers on something, and they would look like Swiss cheese. Somebody had taken an X-Acto knife and cut out anything that would give me information that I wasn't allowed to have. Okay, so one of the things I would do is, as an information assurance guy, I'm looking very far ahead, and I'm figuring out there's always a creep. There's a technology creep. There's a usage creep. There's functionality creep. Everything creeps. And in the 70s, I was running active attacks, chosen input attacks, which everybody knows about, nothing interesting there, except for the fact that SIGINT, when I would propose one of those to them, you can have this thing easily, just do this. And they'd say, we can't do that because that's an act of war. Okay? In the 80s, that suddenly changed. It was no longer an act of war. So I believe that there's still a line in the sand with the Russians. I don't believe that line is there with anyone else. I think that the Russians and the U.S. still have that honorable agreement as the two heavyweights in the game, and everybody else is pushing that line. You know, you talk to countries. The Russians didn't want to get caught doing things, but you talk to other countries, and they say, yeah, we tried. China hasn't been doing that. They've been saying that was private citizens, that wasn't us, but you know it's them. If you look at the Shady Rat report, that's really laid out very, very nicely. So, yeah, that line is really drifting. I was giving a talk at the Air Force Academy, a classified talk, about 2 years ago, and I got a really interesting question. Who gets to make the call that one of these cyber attacks is an act of war? And my answer was not me, but I believe it's only the president can make that call. And it's scary because some of the things that we see going on right now would have been acts of war in the early 80s. So the line is shifting dramatically. I think it's the wild, wild west with no sheriff out there at all. Everybody's doing whatever they want to do. They're being protected by their local governments. Intellectual property is being siphoned off as fast as the bandwidth will allow. It's a mess.
Hi. Another DES question. I'm Perry Metzger, University of Pennsylvania. So although the initial differential cryptanalysis work showed that the strength of DES was pretty much as advertised against differential cryptanalysis, later on, you know, linear cryptanalysis and other techniques showed up, and a few more bits got shaved off. And there were hypotheses to the effect given that at the time that the boxes were designed, that perhaps linear cryptanalysis had not been strength against linear cryptanalysis had not been a criterion. Do you want to comment on that?
Sure. I'll be pretty careful when I comment on that. Our understanding of there are two comments on that. Our understanding of linear was not as good then as it is now. So it also wasn't used in the criteria. Differential was, and linear wasn't. So that's absolutely correct. Our understanding is much better now of linear than it was back then. That was in its infancy. And I had another really good comment, but luckily I'm old enough that I've forgotten it by now. But yes, you're absolutely right. I remember what it was. The other thing that we needed to worry about at that time was the amount of text we thought would be available, and it's that creep. We never really believed that anybody would run an active attack with the amount of text that they talk about in Shamir's papers. So it's not clear we would have really thought that if we knew what we knew today, it's not clear we would have worried about that as being a realistic thing. In 1974, we might have in 1985. So everything creeps. And I remember when I started out doing active cryptanalytic attacks, spoofing attacks, I was told that I could use 2^8 spoofs, and anything that required more than that was unrealistic. I think people are talking about more than 2^8 spoofs these days, if I'm not mistaken.
Steve Belevin, Columbia University. I suspect that since you don't know anything classified about Stuxnet, you don't know anything classified about Flame, which is good. But to me, the really interesting thing about Flame was it reportedly used a cryptanalytic technique unknown in the open literature. Do you have any comments or observations to make about that?
Well, the good news is that, actually, I hadn't heard that comment, but I will check on that later.
It was a way to forge certificates using MD5 that was not known.
Yes, I did remember reading that. And I'm not sure that really wasn't known. It certainly was related to a lot of the stuff that has been discussed. So it's not much of a stretch, but nation states do know some things that the privates don't do. I remember Brian Snow used to be at NSA, was talking out at RSA one time, and he said, you know, wouldn't it be embarrassing if we didn't know more than the outside world? Because you write down everything you know and reread it, and we don't write down anything we know, so you don't get to see it. If we don't know something beyond what you know, we are really pathetic. I think that's probably true. We ought to be a little bit ahead. Plus, we got 1,000 people that are paid to do this 8 hours a day every day, so hopefully they're making some progress.
Hi, Yossi Oren, Tel Aviv University. Thanks for the amazing talk, and I guess for your service as well. Did a lot of important things. I wanted to go back to your comment previously about the situation where you're meeting this CTO technology guy from a company and describing a vulnerability, and you're saying, okay, we're never going to go public with it, but you're going to fix it anyway. And you're getting respect because you're the NSA, and I wanted to hear your comments about this whole discussion about the ethical disclosure, responsible disclosure, because if you're a white hat hacker and you go to a company, say Amazon, and you say there's a vulnerability, you always risk the chance that nobody's going to do anything about it. And it's the only weapon actually you have is threatening to go live with it. And sometimes that's not even enough. Sometimes you have to go further than the threat. So I'm really curious to hear, what do you think is the right and ethical thing to do when you have a vulnerability in your hand?
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. Having a business card that said NSA on it got me in the door, and it got me listened to, because they knew if I went public with it, people were going to pay attention.
Yeah,
I was never going to threaten to do that, but I didn't have to. I know a lot of white hat guys who have exactly that problem. They've gone to companies, they get ignored, they don't even get answered. It's not like they're told to go away, that nothing happens. I feel bad for them. I think that the threat of going public is sometimes the only thing they feel they can do. The other thing you can do is go to somebody like CERT or NSA with the information. If NSA gets information from the outside, we treat it seriously. We will take it to the company. We don't claim it's ours. We pass on the credit to the company from the people who do it. So I don't like the idea of going public. I understand that it may be a last resort, but it is not the right approach. On the other hand, you know, we aren't the smartest people in the world. There are a lot of smart people out there. And other people may well know of things that we discover, and they may not be telling the companies. They may be using them. So it's important to get these things fixed. And unfortunately, after you get it fixed, a lot of U.S. users won't be fixing it anyway. So there's no good answer in this game. If you get the information in a patch, you know bad guys are going to look at the patch and figure out why it was patched, and that's going to give them a target. It's going to give them an attack. We've just got to get better code that we aren't constantly finding problems with, and that's the bottom line. If we can't write decent code, then what are we going to do? We've got to protect the user, and in giving them a product that is full of holes is not protecting the user. And the user is individuals, it's companies, it's government, it's everybody. But that's where we've got to go. Just start off with better products.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Hi there, Juan Lang from Google. I wanted to ask you something a little bit less on information assurance, but thinking more about what Stefan Savage was asking you about with respect to Stuxnet, and thinking how information attacks allow a certain kind of force projection and force amplification that we haven't seen in the past, and how deniability allows us to see acts of espionage or acts of war that are not necessarily between nation states anymore. I was just curious if you could comment on what you think the trend is going to be, right? Where are we going to be from now, 20 years from now, 50 years from now, with respect to what espionage looks like, what warfare looks like?
Yeah, that's a whale of a question. It certainly is true that you've brought new players into the game. One of the dangers of something like Stuxnet is it is, in my opinion, a step up in capability, but we've now given that to the world to look at. It's much like DES was exposed to the world. We've made the world smarter. It's going to be easy to do something similar to that that could have huge ramifications, and we've kind of given every hacker community a tool for them to analyze, get smart on, and perhaps apply. It's scary. Right now, when you look at intent and motivation, there are not a lot of nation states that will want to go in to do something to a critical infrastructure unless they are in an active war. If you're in an active war, then the infrastructure has always been a target, whether it's water supply or fuel supply or whatever. Infrastructure has always been a target. This gives them a new tool to target. The problem is it gives a terrorist group that. Now, the intent and motivation of terrorists has typically been something that's very splashy, very quick, very dramatic, that makes headlines. Taking out a power supply, you know, a power grid, it won't be that fast, it won't be that dramatic, it won't be that splashy. It'll take time for people to die because of that. That doesn't mean it won't happen. It doesn't mean their intent and motivation won't modify. It's a scary world that we're in, and it's only getting scarier. We're getting more and more interconnected, more and more vulnerable. We rely more and more on things like remote maintenance that allow paths in for an adversary. So yeah, it's not a pretty world we're getting to. I like the old days of you had a bomb shelter in your basement better.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm Zach Tatlock from UC San Diego. One theme you've really hammered on is battling this plague of security vulnerabilities from software bugs. And you mentioned earlier that there are automated tools that find bugs, but they don't find all the bugs we care about. So an alternate approach is to actually formally verify the software, to prove it correct in full detail. And I was wondering if you could comment about the feasibility of that approach.
Yeah, I like that approach. There's a lot of work on the outside, formal methods and other types of approaches, maybe formal methods with other approaches as well. The problem with formal methods has been the scaling. I try to find targets for using it, and I'm trying to work with the government to get, we have, at Johns Hopkins, we have a group of people that are working formal methods. We're trying to get the government to use that. When you're rewriting code, you know, you weren't sure that the old code was right, you're rewriting little things, you know, make sure you've done it right. If one of the things we used to do when we looked at something like Vincent, we do a block diagram, we try to figure out the vulnerable parts, the most important pieces. If we can separate those pieces and try to verify those pieces, like on a missile or on a little unmanned reconnaissance machine, a destruct code, that's a very small piece of code. Verify that can't be changed, that can't be wiped out. The problem is you're always going to be able to do things that, like jamming, so that you can't activate it, but at least make sure that it's going to work right. So yeah, I love formal methods. I think it's a great approach. We got to solve the scaling problem, which means we've got to find some way to make it work on big systems or on little pieces that we really care about, and then put the little pieces together. But yeah, you're right. You're never going to find all the problems. You're much better off if you can prove that you've done it right in the first place.
Yeah, I think the insight of verifying sort of a shim is really interesting. I think there's actually a paper at the conference on that idea. Yeah, thanks a lot. I really enjoyed the talk.
Thank you.